The first state visit by an Iranian president to China in more than 20 years, greeted by the Chinese President Xi Jinping on a red carpet. An extraordinary display of camaraderie between the presidents of the two countries. So why should the U.S. be worried? Or does it even matter? In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at this relationship, what it means in the context of the New World Order, and how this bond will, at a minimum, prove futile, the effectiveness of the U.S. sanctions. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. John Ross, Senior Fellow at the Chung-Yang Institute for Financial Studies, joins us from London. From Montreal, we have Arnold August, author and journalist, joining us. Gentlemen, welcome. If I may first start with you, John Ross, taking a look at the visit by Iranian president to China. Obviously, it's a high-profile visit. As I mentioned, it's the first visit in 20 years. And we're looking at not only the fact that they're going to solidify ties even further, no new news there, but they're going to use in a major way the 25-year cooperation agreements as the platform to expand their ties. Can you first, before we even get into that, tell us why Iran is actually important to China?
The economies of China and Iran, well, let's look at the economy, we'll do the politics in a minute, right, are highly complementary. China is the most important manufacturing center in the world's workshop, as it's put it. And Iran is one of the most important suppliers of energy in the world, as well as other things. This makes them highly complementary. Then there are also political reasons, of course, because in China is the biggest country in East Asia, and Iran is a very crucial part of what's called the Middle East, or we might call it West Asia. And then there are a whole series of important countries which they both have ties with as part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. China has relations, and Iran has relations with Russia, Pakistan, India, and other countries. So therefore, the economic foundation is extremely solid. That's why you can have a 25-year basis. And they also have important political interests. So it's very logical that the two want to cooperate.
Taking a look at that 25-year comprehensive agreement, which is one of the major platforms in order to expand the relationship with Arnold August, I guess you can call them rough estimates, about $400 billion when the deal was first announced. How is it that the length of time versus the dollar figure, but more important would be the length of time? How does that constitute the relationship between these two countries when it comes to the geopolitics of the world vis-a-vis the U.S.? Because Iran is fitting with China into the new world order, in a matter of speaking.
Yes, I think that's very significant. Just to add to what John said regarding the economic and political repercussions or reasons to see the importance, historic importance, in my view, of this new Iran-China relationship, I would add the following. Given the, very furious racist attacks against the peoples of the East, such as against China and Iran, and even though Russia is not entirely in Asia, but partly so, it is very significant as a pushback against that the two most important civilizations in Asia, that is China and Iran, are getting together to organize a long-term 25-year cooperation deal. This is very significant, and it will help the resistance to all of the racist innuendos and open attacks against the people of Asia. And of course, the fact that they can have it 25 years indicates very clearly that both countries are solidly in control, the leadership and the people are solidly in control of their sovereignty and in favor of how the development, economic and political development is going on, so that they can assure a 25-year agreement. I was just talking about 25-year agreement recently. As we discussed before, Iran and Venezuela also signed an important 25-year agreement. So this, scenario of long-term agreements is very important. It shows the confidence in these countries that are opposing U.S. hegemony. And yes, you are right. The United States does have something to fear for this growing momentum to oppose U.S. hegemony.
Well, that's what I want to ask you, what that fear should be, John Ross. When you have the Chinese President Xi Jinping say things like, quote, no matter how the international and regional situation changes, China will unswervingly develop friendly cooperation with Iran, or things like opposes external forces interfering in Iran's internal affairs or undermining Iran's security and stability. First of all, this, I'm guessing, would be in a direct reference to the U.S., but what does the U.S. have to fear here?
Well, I'm sure that it applies to any country which carries out interference of the type which has been condemned. But the United States is the main country that's doing it, so doubtless it refers to the United States in particular, but it would be equal applied to any other country that wanted to interfere in that way. What the United States has to fear is not the fact that people are against the United States. No country in its right mind goes out of its way to pick a fight with the United States. The United States remains a very powerful country. Most countries in the world like to have good relationships with the United States. But the problem is that the United States acts against the interests of other countries. This is absolutely clear. Both some cases is directly. For example, the tariffs against China, the sanctions against Iran, the sanctions against Cuba, sanctions against Venezuela. There's very direct attacks, but there are also indirect attacks. For example, the United States is attempting to cut Huawei out of Europe's telecommunications system. What does this mean? It means that everybody in Europe is going to have to pay more for their telecommunications, and therefore this is adverse for the economies in Europe. So this is an indirect attack on European countries. Or indeed, that Europe has been plunged into chaos by US policy. The expansion of NATO eastward, which is what really behind the Ukraine war, has created a situation when Europe now, we've got the highest inflation for 40 years. We've got a big war going on. Contrast that to the situation in Asia. In Asia, you've got developing countries of Asia, you've got every political regime that you can possibly think of, I would think. I mean, you've got socialist countries in Vietnam and China. You've got a monarchy in Thailand. You've got various types of republics. But the one thing that they're determined to do is that they want to pursue their own path of development. They're not going to be blocked from that by the United States. So it's not that countries are attempting to attack the United States, it's that the United States is attempting to attack other countries. The difference is now that many, many countries are not prepared to go along with this. I mean, we can see, for example, on the sanctions against Russia over the Ukraine war, the countries that represent 85% of the world's population have refused to go along with the US sanctions. It's the US which is isolation itself, because it insists upon attacking other people. They don't want to attack the United States, but they will defend themselves if they are attacked.
Well, the way that this trip is being reported, it's not that favorable, Arnold August. Some of the headlines, for example, or the way it's being reported, saying both countries, China and Iran, are facing pressure from Western nations over their positions on Russia's military operation on Ukraine. I mean, the type of pressure that they're talking about, isn't that the type of pressure that the U.S. actually and the U.S.-led NATO placed on Russia in the first place for 7 years when they were getting closer to Russia's borders? You know what I mean? I mean, yes. They're trying to take that importance away from the union of these two countries. Why is it that the importance of this relationship is being dragged to a lower level when it's of significance in the way that it really is when you take a look at the potentialities between the two?
Well, regarding what you say, the United States wants to pressure Iran and China to, abandon their position with regards to Ukraine and instead support indirectly the American NATO narrative and military actions in Ukraine. Well, good luck. It won't happen. It hasn't happened up to now, despite everything, and it won't happen in the future. Now, yes, U.S. is the main culprit, and they are being singled out. But as the way things are going in Eastern Europe, for example, it's not going very well for the United States. While they're trying to force China and Iran to follow the United States, in the United States, it was just announced yesterday that Netherlands and Denmark refuse the U.S., a German proposal to send tanks into Ukraine. So the alliance in NATO is very weak compared to the growing alliance, solid principled alliance between China and Iran and other such entities.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
When you take a look at a particular quote from the Iranian president, John Ross, of which he said, and this concerns sanctions, he said the continuation of sanctions will seriously undermine world peace. That's quite a statement. What are we looking at when it comes to the issue of sanctions and how countries like Iran and China, or Russia and China, and other countries who are moving away from the U.S. when it comes to the reach of the U.S. sanctions, that this would pose somewhat of a threat for the dominance of the U.S. dollar, which obviously affects the U.S. economy once the dollar is threatened?
Well, yes, I mean, the fundamental, I agree very much with this statement, this is a threat to world peace. The reality is that the United States is losing in peaceful economic competition. That this is the fundamental problem. It goes on a lot about how greatly productive its economy is and how great it is. But the reality, the facts show that the US is losing. Okay, let's look at it. During the imposition of the tariffs by the United States against China happened to be a little bit before, but basically overlapped with the period of the pandemic. Okay, we can make a balance sheet of what happened during the pandemic, which is that China's economy grew 2.5 times as fast as the United States during the 3 years of the pandemic. China's continued to develop its international trade, and it hasn't even been forced to cut its exports to the United States. I mean, this is a comprehensive economic defeat that the United States has suffered on the economic field. It also expected, in regard to Iran, that Iran would collapse, et cetera, just as it believed that with sanctions against Russia, Russia would collapse. None of this has happened. The danger in the situation is that the United States, although it's losing in peaceful economic competition, is still the world's most powerful military machine. And therefore, the danger is that it will increasingly resort to military means. This is why it is indeed a threat to peace. The Ukraine war is a new threshold. The United States has carried out attacks on developing countries before, Serbia, Libya, Iraq. This is the first time it's prepared to basically provoke a war with a nuclear armed power, Russia. So this is a very dangerous situation from the point of view of peace. And I entirely agree with this. The U.S. is caught in an infernal logic. Because it can't sort out its own economic problems, it resorts more and more first to sanctions and then also to cold wars. And now we see it's more resorting to hot wars as well. And this is very dangerous.
Another focus of the two countries' ties is something that is probably one of the biggest projects that is being executed in the world, and that is the Belt and Road Initiative here, Arnold August, which, enough can't be said about it because it's so vast and so big. This is something that obviously Iran is a part of because of the route that it takes both via land and also via the sea. It's a project that's obviously in developing as we speak. Now, what's interesting about this, first of all, your reaction to that, But what's interesting about this is the fact that you had the U.S. through the G7 make an announcement last year, was it, that they were going to launch to counter China, and their first announcement was $600 billion. But then there's silence. Nothing said about that countering that they want to do. Tell us what you think also about that, why it is that the U.S. and its G7 partners thought that they could counter China in this huge project.
Well, I think it has to be spelled out a bit that the Belt and Road Initiative is really, historically a momentous breakthrough in terms of expanding a trade and cooperation, political ties between countries of different political system over a very vast territory of land. And, for the United States to even think, even to put it on the agenda, as you said, they did during the G7, to have the equivalent of the Belt and Road Initiative, nothing has come out of it. It's impossible for them to do so. So the Belt and Road Initiative is also tied to other important political and trading blocs, such as BRICS, which includes Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and more countries are asking to be included, such as Argentina and Iran, I believe. So all of these different conglomerations or coalitions, economic and political, are building up. But the main thing I would like to emphasize today, if I may, that China, which has been so much denigrated by the Western powers, United States and others over the centuries, has now turned history on its head. And rightfully so, it's poetic justice that China is at the head, leading this worldwide movement, it is a worldwide movement against U.S. hegemony, to develop a multipolar world where countries of different political orientations, economic levels, etc., can collaborate amongst themselves despite U.S. hegemony. I think that what is happening now, there was a very interesting a title of a Global Times article today from China regarding the meeting between Chinese and Iranian leaders in Beijing today. It said, China-Iran, no need to watch attitude of U.S. In other words, we've been talking about decoupling. Before it was Russia, now China, whole sections of the world are decoupling from the United States and Europe. Not because they want to do so. They were forced to do so as a result of the NATO-U.S. aggression against Russia. So mm-hmm. Now, as the Global Times said from China today, we're past that. We are decoupling. We don't even care what you say about the growing Iran-Chinese relationship. And I think this type of thinking going against U.S. hegemony is very, very significant.
All right. We need to expand a little bit more on this with you, John Ross, when it comes to the Belt and Road Initiative. I'm taking a look at some of the vast landmass that this covers. It starts out in China, and then it goes through countries like, you've got Almaty. I'm talking about the cities now, Almaty, Bishkek, obviously Dushanbe, Tehran, obviously, there also Istanbul in Turkey, Moscow. And it goes all the way to Rotterdam in Germany. This is the land route that we're looking at. On the bottom, I'm looking at the water route where countries like India is there. You've got Africa there. And basically, my question to you is, when you have a project of this size, of which Iran is part of that, and due to Iran's geographic location, obviously it makes it an ideal country to be part of this project, doesn't this mean that these countries then, that China will gain somewhat of a political clout because of their co-op on this huge project, because loans are given out, and therefore these countries then would be doubtful that they would go against China unless something really incredible happens. And that obviously is something, again, that perhaps is not to U.S. liking.
Well, I don't think I don't think it's correct, because the development of any country primarily depends upon its internal situation. So undoubtedly, the capital investments carried out by China are very useful, and they aid countries, and it's a win-win. So therefore, that's good. But they're not enough to determine the economic situation in a country. If the country is developing in a favorable way with a good economic policy, China's investment is very useful. If, on the contrary, a country is pursuing a greatly misguided economic policy, then Chinese investment won't make the difference. But what's the good about the present time is you have a development in the world taken in many countries with countries which are want to develop themselves. If we look at the so-called global south, that is the developing countries, this is just increasing its percentage of the world economy, and in real terms, purchasing power parity terms, already larger than the developed countries. And they want to get on with it. Again, it's not even just in the situation in Asia. I mean, I thought that President Lula, re-elected, has put it recently. He put it very well. He says, Brazil is at war with poverty. It's not at war with Russia. And I think he means by that it's not at war with Iran or China or anybody else. It wants to develop itself. And there's an increase in number of countries. This is why we can see very clearly on the sanctions against Russia, as I say, 85 countries, which have 85% of the world's population, refused to go along with this, despite the pressure of the United States. They've even got some got somewhat different views on the conflict in Ukraine. What they're not prepared to do is to subordinate their national development to the interests of other outside forces. And of course, this is what the United States finds it difficult to accept, because it thinks that it should run, despite the fact about 5% of the world's population, it thinks it should be able to tell the other 95% what to do. And the other 95% are increasingly saying, no, we'll get on with our own business. I agree what was said. China don't have to work out what the United States thinks about this. They just have to get on with good mutually beneficial relations. And the same applies to Brazil. The same applies to many other countries in Asia.
All right. 30 seconds to you, Arnold August, in closing. Whatever comment you'd like to make there.
Well, I think the overall significance of the visit over the last couple of days in China shows once again the complete bankruptcy of the U.S. when they talk about international community. Like John Ross just spelled it out. International community is what? It's the United States and their very fragile, fragile allies in Europe.
Thank you so much. Arnold August, author and journalist from Montreal. John Ross, thank you. Senior fellow, Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mikhail Batakwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, ways of strengthening taqwa through abandoning the material things. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of strengthening the taqwa through abandoning the material things. We know that we are living in the material world, and in this material world, we have some material needs. But the problem occurs where we excessively go towards this material world, or when we consider that everything is this material world. Therefore, it is necessary to do not exceed the limits that are set by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala or the Islamic teachings. Therefore, the moderate way is the best way to be and to have the right way. The moderate way is the best way to follow the Islamic teachings. The moderate way is the best way to have the Islamic life. Therefore, it is necessary to follow the moderate way and do not to exceed the limits in this material world. The problem is we do not believe in Allah the way we should. When we do not believe, when we are under the propaganda of the material world, then our beliefs are not strong enough and they are affected by this material world or the concepts or the things that are being said through this in this material world. The way we study, the educational system that we have, this is all based on this, on the materialism. Therefore, we being a Muslim who believe in God, who believe in soul, who believe in hereafter, who believe that this world is something to work for the hereafter, and the mata of this world, the sustenance of this world is the passing enjoyments, we do not have the firm belief in the context the way we should have. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of strengthening the ways of taqwa through abandoning the material things. We said that it is necessary to follow the way in which we can worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Obviously, when we are abandoning the material things, it means that we are not going towards the material things only in order to gain the material we can say like enjoyments. Why? Because this world is a passing enjoyment, and the things that are provided in this world is for our help, so that we use them as a tool in order to have the best sustenance in hereafter, in order to have the best results in hereafter. Therefore, it is necessary to look at this world as a tool and to use whatever it is provided as the material source in this world as a tool for hereafter. On the other hand, we have the ahadith or the narrations in which it is said, for example, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib has said that haramun ala kulli qalbin mutawallitin bid-dunya. It is haram, forbidden on every single heart to have the love of this dunya, and yaskanahu taqwa. It is haram on the heart in which there is the love of this dunya, the love of this world, that the taqwa should go and reside there. Which means that the taqwa, if we want to gain taqwa, if we want to strengthen the taqwa, we should not have the hubb of dunya, we should not have the love of dunya. Why? Because taqwa does not reside at a place where there is a love for this dunya, where there is a love for this material world, where a person can think that he can just live in this world and this world is the final destination. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the World with reporters.
Lives have been saved in Turkey following recent earthquakes because the country had access to heavy lifting machinery. Experts say many lives were lost in Syria because sanctions prevented the country from having similar equipment. The catastrophe has just been debated in the European Parliament.
Following the disaster, I contacted one of the largest aid agencies in Syria. I've spoken to Italian agencies and other NGOs. They all told me that the EU sanctions present an obstacle to humanitarian work.
European Commission officials told legislators that just 9 of the EU's 27 member states have supplied Syria with support. 21 have scrambled to help Turkey.
The Commission also allocated an additional 3.5 million euros in emergency humanitarian funding to help our partners address urgent needs in Syria.
This 3.5 million euro for Syrians pales into insignificance when compared to the 67 billion euro spent by the EU on Ukraine during the past 11 months. Experts have been saying for years that the bloc lacks unity when it comes to Syria.
Countries are acting in their own way. There is no coordinated action. And this is one of the reasons that we're faced with this very big crisis, this mega crisis.
Efforts by Western nations to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad have failed. Critics say interventionism has brought misery to millions of innocent people in the country. Some lawmakers want the pressure to be paused.
In Syria, there are sanctions. We don't want to see more people die in the cold. They don't have medicines. We must put politics aside and human life first.
It's been announced the EU will host a donors summit next month to gather money for the earthquake-hit regions. Political commentators are claiming it's already obvious that the vast majority of the money raised will go to Turkey, not Syria. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
I am visiting a children's hospital in Kabul, which is said to be overwhelmed with malnourished kids. Every few hours, a sick child is brought into the malnourishment ward, while doctors and nurses are racing against time to save the youngest victims of Afghanistan's crisis.
Unfortunately, this year, undernourished cases, especially severe acute malnutrition, have significantly surged compared to last year. Constant hunger and poverty and differing diseases are to blame for this, which puts us in dire need of more supplies and medical aid.
As you know, Afghans are gripped with poverty and economic problems. As a result, we are overwhelmed with a huge number of malnutrition. We are running out of bed and sometimes we are forced to reject new entries. Besides, childhood wasting as well as child mortality have also soared.
The World Health Organization says in 2023, around 17,000 Afghan babies and mothers are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition, while over 2.3 million children may suffer from moderate acute malnutrition. The UN body adds that an estimated 28.3 million people, which comprises two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, need urgent relief assistance.
We are a family of 10. My husband is a shoemaker. This malnourished child of mine is 3 months old. Two of my children died as a result of wasting and stunting.
Afghan people's miseries are growing day by day. Unemployment, poverty, and famine have gripped the society, with poor and middle-class households being hit hard. Many have brought their malnourished kids here, and I think it is because they have no food in their houses. We are calling on the global community not to ignore Afghans amid political and economic crises.
Concerns are on the rise among Afghans over their isolation from the international community and major cuts in global aid following the Taliban's takeover and U.S. withdrawal from their country. Afghanistan has one of the highest rates of malnutrition in the world. Afghans are calling on the global community not to leave them alone amid poverty and hunger. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Hundreds of people attended a national conference in Gaza, which was organized by Palestinian resistance factions.
The event aims to bolster the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. In recent weeks, extremist Israeli settlers and political figures, backed by regime forces, have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Israeli forces have also killed and injured dozens of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of 2023. Speaking to Press TV, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said the resistance in Gaza is ready to support the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We will not leave the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank alone, and we will back them with all the necessary means. The occupying regime will not be able to divide the Palestinian resistance arenas. Last night, we witnessed unity in Gaza, Nablus, and Al-Quds.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces more than 55 years ago, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom.
Actually, Al-Quds is not just a word. It's something apart from our heart. So this conference asking and telling the world that this Israeli action against Al-Quds and West Bank must be stopped.
Palestinian resistance factions have expressed their unwavering support for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. They also vowed to use all forms of resistance to liberate Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We believe that the Israeli government, under the leading of Netanyahu and Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, going to raising up the aggressive against our people in West Bank, in Jerusalem, in Gaza also, maybe in other outside countries also. So we are going to resist the occupation by all kind of resistance.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank, while turning a blind eye to violations committed by the Israeli regime against them for decades.
Palestinians say that they will continue their struggle against the Israeli regime until the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
On Saturday, protests were held in front of the Italian state broadcaster Rai's premises in a number of cities, including Rome, Milan, and Naples. The protests had been called against the Rai's decision to read out a message by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky during the final night of Italy's biggest entertainment TV show of the year, a song contest, which brings millions of viewers together.
Noi oggi siamo.
We are here today to remind our politicians the suffering we had to go through for decades after World War II. This man in the photo is my grandfather. He died during that war. We are against the bellicose propaganda broadcast on state TV.
Earlier this week, state broadcaster Rai opted to withdraw a planned video address by Zelensky at the popular TV show and replace it with the reading of a message sent by the Ukrainian leader.
I would have preferred Zelensky to have been present at the TV show. I've appreciated his decision to send a written message and, above all, I'm sorry about the controversy that was stirred up.
We say no to the politicization of culture, no to Zelensky on our TV shows, no to a man who is leading his country to destruction for a war that had been planned for years by the U.S.
The move by Rai to host Zelensky has inflamed the debate on the war in Ukraine in Italy, a country where support for Kiev is more divided than elsewhere in Europe. Since the start of the conflict, surveys in Italy have showed that more than half of the Italians are against supplying Kiev with more weapons.
Many accuse Rai of providing information which is not impartial because the National Broadcaster's Board of Directors is directly linked to the government and the parliamentary majority. As a matter of fact, following a 2015 reform, 6 out of 7 Rai board directors are elected by the 2 houses of parliament and the government.
Chiaramente, la RAI.
Italy's state broadcaster is now more than ever in the hands of the politicians. RAI and the government want Zelensky to appear on the television of millions of Italians to make them believe that this Ukraine war is a good war and that sending weapons to Kiev is a good thing.
Italy's Prime Minister Meloni has repeatedly said that supporting Ukraine is the best way to reach a possible negotiated settlement with Moscow, and that Rome aims to be a lead player in that regard and in Ukraine's reconstruction. Max Civili, Rome.
The National Media Association in Lebanon held a gathering in the capital, Beirut, to show solidarity with the Syrian people who continue to suffer because of the U.S. sanctions imposed under the so-called Caesar Act. The journalists, media figures, politicians, and representatives of the Resistance Front noted that Syria stood with the resistance groups when the world had abandoned Palestine and Lebanon, and that now is the time to stand with Syria.
From Beirut, the National Media Association announces the Beirut Declaration and calls on the Arab and Islamic people and the free people in the world to work on confronting oppression and stopping the wars of sanctions and famine, which are against basic human rights.
The U.S. State Department has claimed that the sanctions do not target humanitarian aid, but Monday's earthquake has proven the opposite.
It's a mere maneuver by the United States just to confront this wave of indictment to the United States, and it's a way for them to reimpose the sanctions in order to achieve their geopolitical agenda. I believe that we need to keep pressuring the United States, exerting pressure, moral and material pressure, in order to lift the sanctions of Syria.
Over 3,000 people have so far died as a result of the catastrophic earthquake in Syria, as rescue teams continue to search for survivors under the rubble of the buildings, which have been completely leveled to the ground. In addition to rescue efforts, the Syrian people are in dire need of essentials like medicine and fuel, which have not been allowed to enter Syria because of the Western sanctions.
They cannot still like turning around sending humanitarian aids to Syria through NGOs or others. It should be through the governments of Syria. After all, the government is doing all the necessary job to help people and to take them to hospitals or to make shelters or so.
On February 6th, the 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck Turkey and Syria, killing thousands in the two countries. While countries like Iran and Russia have sent aid to Syria, the amount of humanitarian assistance that reached the Arab country is still very little compared to the international aid sent to Turkey.
At least five rescue teams from Lebanon headed directly to Syria to provide all the assistance they can of the rescue efforts, yet many are saying the aid that many are providing is not enough. Participants here today stressed that the U.S. and its Western allies need to lift the unjust sanctions against Syria and the Syrian people. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Ibrahim Raisi is in Beijing for a three-day state visit. That's the first such trip by an Iranian president to China in 20 years. Upon his arrival, he was welcomed by his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping. During their meeting, the two presidents sounded determined to strengthen the two countries' partnership, both vowing to work toward implementation of the 25-year Strategic Cooperation Pact, whatever international conditions be.
We believe that implementing the 25-year cooperation agreement and realizing what agreed between the two countries' officials today to develop bilateral ties can promote regional and global peace and stability. Certainly, relations between Iran and China will not be affected by international developments, since we're determined to develop ties with China in any circumstances.
China will continue to be committed to consolidating and deepening relations with Iran. I'm willing to work with President Raisi to enhance strategic communication and promote the steady and sustained growth of the comprehensive strategic partnership between the two countries.
Of course, the two presidents had much more to say. Raisi said there is still much more for expanding economic and trade collaboration between the two sides, adding that such collaboration would contribute to peace and stability across the globe. On the other side, Xi hailed China's growing solidarity with Tehran, saying the two countries have supported each other in the face of complex global challenges. He added that China supports Iran's efforts to safeguard its national sovereignty and independence and counter hegemony and unilateralism. Political analyst Christopher Hilali says further deepening of Iran-China ties will greatly strengthen the developments of a multipolar world.
The deepening of ties further strengthens the development of a multipolar world against what both the Chinese and the Iranians said was the ongoing hegemony and unilateralism of Western domination, specifically led by the United States.
Iranian academic Said Mohammad Marandi, who is accompanying the Iranian delegation in Beijing, says the West antagonistic attitude has accelerated convergence among Asian nations.
Asia alone, through this natural convergence, which is being pushed forward even faster, largely due to the fact that the United States and the Europeans are constantly antagonizing governments and sanctioning governments, whether it's Russia, whether it's Iran, and increasingly China, and also by constantly trying to prevent India from establishing greater ties with these Asian powers. The United States and Europeans are pushing these countries towards greater convergence at a faster pace.
Tehran-Beijing cooperation has been only growing over the past couple of years. China has now become Iran's largest trading partner, with figures showing volume of trade between the two rose by over 40% in the previous Iranian calendar year, which ended on March the 20th. Moreover, Iran is joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a key regional bloc where China is a co-founder. Iran is also eager to contribute to China's mega project, the Belt and Road Initiative. China and Iran now appear set to take their partnership to the next level for prosperity of their nations.
Once again, the International Fajr Film Festival brought together filmmakers and movie critics from across the world, as well as movie lovers, this time for its 41st edition. A festival made even more special considering that the international section was reintegrated into the national festival after 6 years of holding separate events.
This year, 26 feature-length movies from 25 countries were competing in the international section. For many of them, this is their regional premiere. The movie market also allows producers and filmmakers to get to know each other and negotiate further cooperation.
I've attended the festival on behalf of the Ministry of Culture of Russia, and based on what I've seen in the past 10 days, I believe that there is a great potential for joint production.
And for those keeping an eye on the festival, the award ceremony was what they'd been waiting for.
Jaishan Kalariar, the director of this movie.
Our jury made a slight change to the order. You'll know that it's initially for best director, but we decided that instead we would like very much to give it to a new and promising filmmaker who's both written and directed his film, so congratulations to him.
I would like to dedicate this award for the three filmmakers whom I admire, Mr. Abbas Kiarostami, Asghar Faradi, and Majid Majidi.
I'm an engineer by profession, but when I got a lot of free time, I used to watch a lot of cinema. And when I watched Iranian films, they had a great influence in my style. And three filmmakers, specific, Abbas Kiarostami, Asghar Faradi, and Majid Majidi have influenced my filmmaking style a lot. And my film is a byproduct of their films.
In the national section, 24 movies were picked out of 87 entries to compete for the top award. What made the national section stand out this year was a whole new generation of first-time directors from different provinces across the country.
Taking part in a festival is what motivates most of us working in the business, and I can tell you for sure that the competition was really tough this year with young up-and-coming directors who participated.
As far as I know, there were lots of young directors taking part this year, so I can tell you for sure that this wasn't an easy competition.
With all of its glitz and glamour and prestige, the 41st Fajj International Film Festival has come to an end, but this time promising new horizons for first-time directors. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
Perhaps anticipating a hero's welcome, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky travelled to the Belgian capital on Thursday with a list of demands. He has asked for long-range missiles and warplanes to use against Russian forces. He also wants Kiev to be granted EU membership without delay.
Of course, membership, and that's why, of course, we need it this year. And this year, Charles, when I say this year, I mean this year.
Those with intimate knowledge of how the EU works believe it is a pipe dream.
Turkey will not be pleased because they are already waiting since 2005 in formal discussions. Then we have the Western Balkans. Also there, something is boiling in Bosnia and Serbia. So these countries, they will say, wait a minute, what about us? And for sure, there are definitely member states who will block this.
EU leaders concluded their latest summit on Friday. The most up-to-date cost of supporting Ukraine was revealed. And it's eye-watering.
67 billion of support we have mobilized in the last 12 months, from budget support to fast recovery, from energy supply to military capabilities, from humanitarian aid to refugee support, and we must do more.
A number of EU lawmakers encourage solidarity with Ukraine, but also want support for the bloc's own hard-pressed citizens.
Solidarity with our most vulnerable, who struggle to put food on the table or heat the home, or those in difficulty maintaining a roof over their heads.
While Zelensky was touring Europe, who was running the show back in Kiev? US and NATO commanders? The Kremlin has warned Western powers not to become too involved in the conflict.
There's no doubt EU citizens have a great deal of sympathy and empathy for the people of Ukraine. But there's growing concern about the level of pressure, some might call it provocation, being exerted on Russia by Western leaders. Many are nervously asking, when might Putin say, enough is enough? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Martyrdom of the Seventh Imam. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam and welcome to the program. We offer heartfelt condolences to our listeners on a very doleful day, which the faithful commemorate every year on the 25th of the month of Rajab. Today is the tragic day when the Prophet's seventh infallible heir was martyred in Baghdad through a fatal dose of poison during imprisonment by the usurper Abbasid regime in 183 AH, corresponding to 799 AH. He reposes in eternal peace in the sprawling twin-domed gold-plated shrine of Qazimain, where people flock day and night and pay their respects to him by saluting him in an appropriate manner, such as, "Peace on you, O representative of Allah and the son of his representative. Peace on you, O the decisive argument of Allah and the son of his decisive argument. Peace on you, O light of Allah in the darkness of the ignorant world. Peace on you, O guide who showed the right path. Peace on you, O symbol of religion and piety. Peace on you, O treasurer of the wisdom of the prophets. Peace on you, O vicegerent of the guardians of the past. peace on you, O depository of the manifest revelations. Peace on you, O possessor of certitude knowledge. Peace on you, O treasury of the messenger's knowledge. Peace on you, O murdered martyr. Peace on you, O son of the messenger of Allah and the son of his successor. Peace on you, O my Lord Musa ibn Ja'far. What you heard were phrases from the special ziyarat, or standard form of salutations, for the seventh infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Named Musa in honor of Prophet Moses, peace upon him, he acquired the epithet of Kazem, or the patient one who refrains from anger. In view of the vicissitudes of life through which he passed during the 35 years of his mission. Born in Abwa between the holy cities of Mecca and Medina in the year 128 AH, corresponding with 745 AD, he was only 55 years old when Harun, while immersed in pleasures in Raqqa in Syria, sent a fast-paced emissary to Baghdad to instruct the despicable jailer, Sindi bin Shahak, to kill the Prophet's heir in such a way that no sign would remain of any foul deed on the body of the victim. It is an irony of Islamic history that charlatans, debauchees, apostates, and infidels masqueraded as caliphs and made Muslims forcibly obey their will by distorting the tenets of religion, while the divinely designated heirs of the Prophet and the inheritors of the pure and pristine Sunnah wa Sirah, that is, the practice and behavior of the Messenger of God, were persecuted. After having martyred Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, the assassin had the court officials testify with signatures on a long scroll that no foul act had been done and the venerable prisoner had died on a natural death. Sindi then left the corpse on the bridge over the river Tigris unattended. Were the people of Baghdad Muslims? Did they adhere to the practice and behavior of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny? Didn't they know that the corpse was that of the son and successor of the Prophet's sixth infallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him? Then why didn't they oppose the Abbasids? The answers to such questions are obvious. Muslim conscience had died long ago, ever since the caliphate was hijacked at Saqifa Bani Sa'da in Medina by a group of usurpers, while the Prophet still lay unburied and while his bereaved Ahlul Bayt, or immediate family members whose authority and purity God himself has vouchsafed in the Noble Quran, were busy in the state of mourning performing the last rites of the seal of messengers. So there is nothing to be surprised at the attitude of self-styled Muslims, whether in the past, when the chosen ones of God were brutally martyred, or at present, when innocent and defenseless men, women and children are either mercilessly bombed by Saudi aircraft in Yemen, or torn to pieces by bomb blasts in Afghanistan, triggered by Daesh terrorists who shamelessly called themselves Muslim. The faithful, however, remain undaunted. They adhered firmly to the God-given political and spiritual rights of Imam Ali, peace upon him, as proclaimed by the Prophet, and they provided burial to the seventh Imam in Baghdad while assisting his son and successor Imam Reza, peace upon him, who miraculously came from Medina to conduct the last rites of his father. these days as well, despite the dastardly acts of the Takfiri heretics and their terrorist masters,